Hello and welcome to this week's Standing with Refugees podcast, and thank you for joining us. I'm Paul Hutchings, one of the founders of Refugee Support Europe, and this week I'm talking to Dina Nyeri again, who is an author and who visited us at Katsikas earlier this year. Hello, Dina.
Hi, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Nice to talk again. Thank you for the article that just came out in The Guardian last week, which was long and detailed, very exciting for us. It sort of took me back to March when the two of us were in those camps.
It was amazing. It's funny how many months have passed and there's so many details that are just freshly in my mind from that visit.
Yeah, I mean, and I think at the time, the thing that was in my mind was how was this was going to be for you, because it was going back to a refugee camp, having lived on a refugee camp yourself, and it was the kind of perspective that was completely new to me. Well, I'm interested now to hear how that is for you, now you've had time to reflect on it.
Yeah, there were a lot of very quick moments that ended up being far more important to me on reflection than I knew at the time. So, you know, I actually sat down after I came back from, because you and I, we also went to LM Village and to Katsikas, and LM was particularly moving for me because it was, you know, it had been turned into a refugee camp from, you know, an old holiday village. And the refugee camp that I lived in used to be a hotel. So in that sense, there was a parallel that, you know, was kind of haunting. And then afterwards, when we went to Katsikas and I got to see the store and kind of the effect of it on people, there was just so much that happened all at once that it took, I think, a lot of reflecting and months of reflecting for it to all settle in and for me to make sense of it. And when I sat down to write, I actually sat down to write not just that article, but simultaneously, you know, a chapter in my upcoming book about camps. And it was just so much rushed out. And it was all just these parallels and how things have changed. Like, you know, I think for me, there's just something incredibly disheartening and undignified about turning these old places of kind of recreation and vacation and luxury into a place for these people and then to abandon them. So that was kind of weighed heavy, you know. And then, of course, the store itself, you read in the article, like there were just a lot of moving moments for me, talking to the Iranians when I shouldn't have, or bagging the groceries too early when they hadn't finished, you know, doing the internal negotiations with their families, that kind of stuff. You know, it just kind of stays with you, doesn't it?
Yeah, that was interesting to me to read that, because what was interesting was how much of an impact that experience had on you, because I suppose I've just seen so many of these interactions that maybe I've become a less sensitive to how much of an impact it does have on people.
Well, you know, I don't think that's true. I think actually, well, I think there's two things to it. First of all, yes, there's the first time, you know, but there's also the fact that, like, I was going in trying to connect this experience with an old childhood one. And I think if you go into any situation with that in mind, you'll see the experience changing. And I think that's kind of the writerly hat, right? I think writers go and try to squeeze every experience for meaning, and so we get good at it. A part of it is that. But I think actually I remember some of those key moments talking to you about them when we were there. Like, for example, you know, the bagging too soon, or when somebody came and complained about, oh, these points were miscounted and you had to be absolutely strict. You know, all of that, actually, the way you spoke about it was laden with previous, you know, heartbreaking experiences, you know, like you could hear it in the things that you said, even in your very English, you know, no, this is how it must be done. And I'm not going to go any further into it. It's not without, you know, some revelation there.
Yeah, I mean, let's go back to LM Village, because one of the things that strikes me about that place, apart from the sort of rundown holiday homes, you know, coming back to what you say there, is it was a place where people went on holidays and had fun, and it clearly isn't now. And that's very visible when you look at things like the overgrown football field, or the tennis court that's been taken over by the dogs.
Yes, or, I wrote about that.
Or the fenced off, you know, swimming pool, you know, which has got this sort of big fence around it now, you know, and it's full of kind of dead leaves and twigs. So.
Yeah.
And so I guess that there was the very strong link there to the hotel where you spent some time in Italy.
Well, yes, I don't remember that, you know, Hotel Barba is what it was called, being quite as run down as this one. But, you know, I had a child's perspective. And so when I was at LM, I tried to see the surroundings from the perspective of those children. Like, do they notice that this rec room is like an absolute, you know, hovel? Or do they notice the ironic little details, you know, like the coffee cups here with no coffee cups, you know, the sign that said coffee cup? But, you know, that kind of thing, you know, who knows if they see it, and who knows what I saw and how much I was able to glean when I was just a kid. But I think it's so much about the concept, you know, the idea that when these places get converted, suddenly there is no one to pay attention to them. They just kind of hand you the carcass of the thing and then and say, oh, look, you're living somewhere nice. But what's made the place nice before was the attention and the service and the people caring for each other. You leave it and it's just nothing but a ghost of that old thing that it was. So, you know, it becomes just ironic and haunting. And I imagine a very depressing place to live, like almost like setting up shop in a library with no books, you know, like, and then telling yourself that it's a library, you know, and that you're, you know, therefore living somewhere scholarly or, you know, working somewhere scholarly when really, you know, it's just a room that used to be something. And I think spaces carry some residue of the old purpose that they served.
Sure. Yes, well, the good news, I mean, if there is any in this, is that we did go back to LM Village and we've been there May. Yeah, so we've run a shop there now. And in fact, George has sort of provided a much bigger space for the shop now as well, which we moved into about 3 weeks ago. So it's a much bigger, more spacious shop. And, you know, that food and everything that we give is important, but it is, as you were just saying there, it's much more about being there and showing to people that, you know, that there are people who care.
Yeah. No, I think that's one of the things that the store adds to the campus. I mean, I only saw one store as it was working, but I could very clearly tell that it was adding this, you know, I guess, sense of life and help and camaraderie and community to the place, you know, because what is the first thing that happens when an actual community is erected in the world? I mean, a store, right? And, you know, at CathCast, you know, that space outside where people were kind of milling about and chatting. And then, of course, just the act of shopping itself, it just brings somehow to life the place. And I remember, like, one of the things that I had written about LM Village when I visited was, I guess, the kind of parallel experience that you and I had looking at the piles of discarded clothes. You know, on the one hand, like, I was remembering the discarded clothes that they kind of threw in the courtyard at Hotel Barba to tell us, you know, oh, pick through these. And you were thinking of like all the work that you had done to put together the clothing store. And here it was, you know, in shambles. And then aside from that, there was people just kind of drifting idly. I mean, they're just kind of like without purpose and without any kind of markers of time when the store wasn't there, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there but not there. And I think I have this, you know, one of the things that we try and talk about as a volunteer organization is how important the volunteers are, not because they turn up to do things, but because they bring so much more, which is this sort of really strong desire to help. And, you know, sometimes that's something we need to try and rein in a little bit because, you know, they want to try and do more than is physically or within our power to do. But there's the details, the caring, the sort of really wanting to help, which adds so much more to the just running a store, you know, just giving out food. It's not what we do. We try and give people something a bit special to say, look, I know this situation is awful, but, you know, we're going to be here for you and at least show that we care and treat you like normal human beings.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's like just the presence of people doing work on a schedule in a place just it changes a place. I think that was the thing that was missing from LM. I'm really glad you guys are back. You know, do you remember when we saw the place where the store used to be and there was like a guy living there and it just...
Yeah, it was weird, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I could see for you, the whole experience was incredibly strange.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. His clothes were hanging where we had flour and sugar.
Yeah, exactly. Well, but the thing is, because it looked like a storefront kind of space,
yes,
the front, there was these windows that looked out onto the street-like area. So he's just looking out into the world and the world was looking at him.
That's right. I mean, one of the thoughts that I also had, Dina, was, you know, how you would feel when you went back to normal life. And I kind of have these sorts of concerns about everybody who comes to visit the camp, about what life's like when they go back. How was it for you?
I had this thing that was happening while I was with you the whole time. And I don't know if I told you about this, but, you know, while I was traveling in Greece, we had just moved into a new flat and we were, you know, building a little shed and waiting for furniture arrivals, you know? And so I would get these texts from my partner that this arrived or that arrived. And there was this incredible sense of guilt that I was like actually in the midst of building a home, while in this place of displacement and homelessness. And you know, it seemed just so frivolous at the time to be thinking about like the shape of a couch. And yet I had to kind of force myself into that kind of thinking. And afterwards, as I was trying to unpack it, I thought, you know, I actually do carry around a ton of guilt for very, very basic kinds of things, or what the West, I guess, considers basic things. Like, I've never really been able to settle down in one place before now, before I had a baby and, you know, kind of settled down in England. But before that, I moved every 2 or 3 years, and I was completely unattached to my things, my furniture. It was all very minimalist. And I think it was just this, you know, feeling that I would not only always be on the move, but that I should always never really get attached to a place, not only because it could be taken away, but also the feeling of guilt. Like, why would I mass things when there's this, you have to do a lot of forgetting, I suppose, to live the way the Western people, like all of us do.
Forgetting?
Yeah, you have to just do a lot of forgetting about, you know, what's happening in the rest of the world, what people lose, what they don't have, which I'm not trying to be judgmental of any lifestyle, but what I mean is that trying to hold those two things in your mind at the same time does quite a number sometimes.
It does. I'm just pondering on that one. And one of the things I've noticed over the last couple of years is that the coming back home has got harder and harder. And it's not, I mean, the leaving thing is easy, but there is this sort of transition time for me, having spent, you know, I don't tend to go for more than a couple of weeks, but having spent a couple of weeks working in Greece, the first few days when I come back, I do feel very disconnected and quite odd, and it takes a little while to settle back into home.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting, because I think there's, well, not only the just vast difference between the two places, but then there's also the fact that I think like, this being your work and your purpose, you know, I can't imagine like the central thing that I'm doing with my time and with my talents just being like many, many miles away. Do you know what I mean? I think that's your own, the unique challenge of your job. But of course you can't like move your family to the camp.
No.
That would be a bad idea. Yeah.
And I mean, just mentioning, thinking about the work there, I mean, how, to what extent are you a writer because of your past?
Well, that's, you know, that's hard to decipher, you know, kind of any small change in your past could completely redirect you, I mean, I suppose. But I think, you know, writing and storytelling is a part of my culture as an Iranian. The thing is that having been a refugee makes me able to be a writer for several reasons. One, because in Iran, as a woman who was pretty academically inclined, there's no way anyone would let me be a writer. If I had stayed there, one, I would have to be a doctor, engineer, or something like that. And second, being that this was such a formative, shocking kind of experience, there was 16 months of being a refugee, that now I had something to say, brewing. I didn't have it to say for 20 years, but it was brewing, you know. And then, of course, you know, being accepted and being granted asylum gave me access to an American education, which was, you know, another factor. So I guess all of those things, but actually not just an American education, but an American sense of I should do whatever pleases me. And that too didn't come for another 20 years, but it was a result of having been kind of having had the door opened for me to the West. So all of these combinations of things pretty much drive everything that I write about. You know, I whether directly or indirectly, it's always about displacement.
Yeah. And so, and that tension runs through your writing, and you're currently working on a new book at the moment.
Yes, I am. Well, you know, last year in 2017, I wrote this essay called The Ungrateful Refugee. I think we talked about it last time we talked on this podcast.
Yeah.
But, so, you know, I was then asked to write a book, you know, kind of not based on that, kind of jump with that as a jumping off point. And the book is partly memoir, but it's partly my experience of the last year and a half or so, you know, trying to get into, you know, I guess back into refugee communities and back into understanding the refugee experience, kind of looking at all of those memories that I have much more directly kind of in the face. And you were a part of that. Refugee support was a part of that. And so, you know, the book kind of brings together, I guess, all of those stories. A huge chunk of it, I have to say, is set in Greece on our trip, because, you know, the book is divided into five sections, and they're the phases, I suppose, of the arc of the refugee experience, starting from escape through to camp and asylum and so on. And the chapter on camp, you know, it's a very deep dive into my own memories, a lot of which was brought up again by this trip. And then, of course, many stories that there wasn't room for in this article that just came out, you know, from all the walking around and knocking on doors at Katsikas and, you know, sitting down to dinner with that family in LM Village and all of the little, you know, trade-offs we had to make. Do you remember when we had that dinner and they had so little and they were so insistent that we eat it, you know? And of course, you can't say no. You can't, you know, trample over someone's pride just so you can, you know, save them an extra chicken thigh. It's Middle Eastern culture. You have to eat it. And then you know you've just eaten their dinner.
Yeah. For anyone listening, that Ungrateful Refugee you can easily find on the Guardian website. It's a really great read. And it's great to hear that you're expanding on that in a book. And I was just interested in your trajectory there where you were talking about, you know, those five stages. And I guess that's fairly linear. And what I see with working with refugees, the two things that I'm always struggling with is, one is this label. And, I use it, but I mean, I try and use people as much as possible. But, you know, it still is describing an experience. One of the things about that label is that, you know, it kind of fits, I suppose, better for people who have just fled. But I mean, I know I work with some people here locally in Brighton who fled a long time ago. That is part of their experience, part of their past, but they don't want to be seen just as refugees. Of course not. You know, they're people with lots of other experience as well, and that kind of label defines them in ways that perhaps they want to be seen in other ways.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's kind of like, you know, this Lazarus moment. The miracle of your escape is so huge that it, of course, will define you always. And I think it's also very, very hard to share your culture with people without somehow stumbling back into the escape story, you know? I found after we had come from Iran, for all of, you know, those years that I was in Oklahoma and kind of growing up as a teenager, I don't think there was once where I told just stories from Iran that somehow didn't within 10 minutes lead to, oh, and then how did you escape? And then, well, oh my gosh, and let's talk about that. And then the story just started there. It remade a lot and reshaped a lot of your memories and your feelings about yourself. Whereas after I had the distance and the age, I suppose, to really think through it, my identity was created in a village in Iran with particular customs and with particular habits. And those things were all fully formed well before I even had to think about, you know, leaving. But of course, you know, having had that experience, the world doesn't let you, you know, shape it the way that you want to shape it. You know, the story has to be this one way, you know.
How political is your book?
Well, everything is political, especially these days. I feel like directly or indirectly, a lot of writing, most writing is political. But this, you know, I'm writing about refugees. The book is titled Ungrateful Refugee. It is very political, but it's not a lecture. It's stories. And it's actually one of the things that surprised me was how many moments of tenderness between refugees and non-refugees there are that I witnessed or somehow experienced, and just how much I learned that was actually much, much softer than one would think from a title like that. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, at the end of the day, it is a story about individuals. It's a book about individuals and, you know, about how easy it is really to make someone's life better and how not so complicated all of these issues are when you take them down to the individual level. I think it's something you've discovered with your work. Mm-hmm. And so it circles around that. Much more than say this is what we should do on a macro level about the refugee crisis.
Yes, I mean, I think I've got much better insight in terms of how to make life a bit more bearable and how to make things better and how to give people an opportunity to be effective and help in a way that is truly helpful. But the one thing that I do struggle with is particularly in an era where there does seem to be, let's say, in US policy right now, a decline in acceptance of refugees or willingness to help. And how best to persuade people to be more welcoming, to open their arms a little bit more, to change policy in a bit more of a kind of open, welcoming way.
Yeah, you know what, that one's hard because people are so disconnected in the way they think about macro and micro issues. So, for example, you have someone who vehemently is anti-immigration, you know, in, let's say, someone in the middle of America who, you know, thinks of, you know, refugees as, you know, swarms or, you know, all of that language. And then, you know, that maybe the a neighbor moves in and that neighbor is from Iran or Syria or Afghanistan. And then I guarantee you half the time they get to know that person and like them. And then they turn around and say, oh, but that guy's an exception. He's an upstanding guy. Most of them are swarms. You know? And until they get someone who thinks that way, who's so uncritical of their own experiences, meets every single refugee out there, they're just not going to think differently. It feels hopeless almost in that way to try to. And so I just kind of keep coming back to the individual, the saying, like, if at least we can show people that their lives won't be greatly altered, but will actually be enriched by the presence of lots of different kinds of people, all of whom have something unique and wonderful and beautiful to bring. If people can just kind of accept that on a personal level, just that one neighbor, then let them have their crazy political points of view, I suppose. I know that's not the right answer, but you know what I mean. It feels as though, I guess, as a writer, my aim and my mission, or what I can add, is to try to get people to think that way. You need to try to feel something on an individual level, or to read a story on a page just about two people and to feel kind of a little bit of a tremor of emotion. And maybe that can be enough.
I love it. That's probably a good point to end on, and I hope that that does work. I think we can only hope. Thank you very much, Dean. I know you're running up against a lot of writing deadlines at the moment, so I really appreciate your time. It's lovely to catch up again.
Great talking to you.
Hopefully we can do it again sometime. You come out and visit.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I want to come back and I want to bring Sam.
Brilliant. When will people find your book coming out?
In May 2019, yeah.
Good. Well, look out for that, everybody. Thank you, Dina, for Standing with Refugees, and thank you to everyone for listening. We talk to someone every week and make it available to download on Monday. Most Mondays. You can subscribe on Podbean and iTunes, download, find it on our website. Please tell us what you think. You'll find us if you do a search on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Google, if you have a search for Refugee Support Europe. If you've got any suggestions about who we can talk to, please let us know. Thank you.